A word to the wise, we are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week we are finishing Before They Are Hanged. Yeah.
The three?
I was just going to say, so I expect them all to be about hanged now. Because we're done with the before of it.
Yeah, the next book is just called Hanged. All right.
Or they
hey
are
there,
hanged.
This is Cross. They are hanged. Fuck.
This is PJ. Hi, sorry, folks.
We are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as our intoxicating weekly book club. We're already a mess. We didn't even do a Devil's Cut right before this because the newest episode of Dark Matter isn't out and you haven't yet watched House of the Dragon.
But
we're doing that tomorrow, which is fine. And it will come out on time. Won't be a big deal.
I've got some editing to do. That comes out in a couple days. But this episode that we're recording now.
Oh, comes God. Out fuck the timeline.
In a week and a few days.
I've forgotten the timeline. I mean, not that we ever, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Just because of the way that one week happened, everything. Mm-hmm. Once again, cheers to Andrew. Andrew's good. It's been a week since that happened, which is it's a lot.
It's time.
It's time, man. It's time. But today, again, is our final episode talking about Before They're Hanged by Joe Abercrombie. This week, we are reading Hold the Line through Back to the Mud. I want to start off kind of in a little bit of a different note. There's no need for a quick overview, in my opinion, because, you know, there's only four chapters. Most of them kind of align directly with each other.
Yeah, there's also no need for an overview because PJ forgot to write one.
Well, I mean, I was okay with it.
Yeah, I totally forgot that we do that every week now.
Yeah, no,
it's rushing okay. to finish the notes. I had a weird, like, rescheduled meeting, and it, yeah, went later than I usually
We've
end
had a couple
up
of weird
finish
days.
Working, so it's all good.
It's been a weird month so far, yeah, but it will be a-okay. I would love to hear, though, instead of the quick overview, I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on the whole and your, on, like, this week's reading, but then also your, like, concluding thoughts on the book itself. As far as it relates to your thoughts in like the series and maybe a little bit more. And we'll obviously talk about more about this in our wrap up eventually, but just curious on some quick levels. But before we do that, PJ, a shot for Three Trees and Cathal.
I guess two shots then, huh? I'll take one. You take
just one. Oh, sure. Yeah. A shot apiece.
What are you shooting, Crossland?
Just shot. Reikia, our unofficial official vodka. Mm-hmm. Of Devil's Cuts. What'd you have?
I had Reposado Terramina Tequila, which is cool. In my cocktail for today. So, little sneak peek.
Nice. Very exciting. Now to the questions, though, PJ.
How do you feel? I didn't answer those yet, did I?
Nope.
Man, this week's chapter this week's section doesn't feel like four chapters. It feels like eight or nine. Like, so much happens, especially holding the line. I had genuinely, like, when I got done reading it, I thought I had gone through like three chapters. Because there's just so much back and forth and so much intense shit that happens.
Unrelenting.
It really is.
For, you know, 30 pages. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but nonetheless, it felt good. I felt very satisfied by it. I should revise that. I felt like this book ends well in a way that I'm like unsatisfied by a lot of the characters and positions right now. Like I'm simultaneously unsatisfied and satisfied about that unsatisfaction.
Okay.
In a weird state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. How do you feel about the sort of at this point, the overall state of the books, as far as like they compare, like this versus The Blade itself, how are you feeling about the series kind of as we've progressed?
So we talked about in our final episode of The Blade itself, we talked about how there's a common complaint that the first book feels very unfocused. And I agreed, but wasn't put off by that, I think is how I landed on that. And now I can totally understand where that's coming from with so much more focus going into this book and much more like, well, a lot of our perspectives are together. So there's fewer like, mm-hmm. oh, this person's going that way and this person's doing this. And it's a lot less fractured in that respect. But there's still intrigue and unique perspectives to be had, even amongst like Jazal, Logan, and Pharaoh's perspectives, all going in the same direction, but having such different insights. It felt really cool. I think I like this book better than the first one, but that by no means means that I disliked the first one.
I wouldn't anticipate that by any means. I'm just curious, you know, on where you kind of stand on this and on the series on the whole, you know, like, and now that you've gone through, you know, a first book is always a first book. It establishes everything. It kind of sets the tone. You know, it does a lot of lifting in a variety of ways. It can be satisfying or unsatisfying. But a second book is where you see the author generally double down on things, right, in a bigger sense, and like establish more things that are potentially going to pay off or otherwise, right? And you've already been in the world. So all the easy stuff is generally done by the time the second book rolls around, mm-hmm. which can sometimes make it harder. But you're on the other side of that, of like appreciating the second book more than the first. Cool.
And you say things pay off. Things explicitly don't pay off in this one.
Well, yeah. Yeah, they don't. I mean, some things do pay off.
Yeah. No, obviously. I know what you mean. I just needed to jab at that.
The payoff of not having a payoff is perhaps one of my favorite twists in fiction.
Mm-hmm. A hollow fetch quest.
Yeah, yeah, right? Was like, well, we'll have a wide conversation about that when we get to it, because I think that there's a lot of great like thematic things that we can get into. And I'm very excited for our wrap up with Leanne over at Leanne's Library, because she also has excellent thoughts and like approaches on this subject. So I'm very excited to kind of get into that.
Perfect.
All right. With that, we're going to lean in one last time into this book. We're going to break down the longest chapter of either of these books by a long shot, and maybe the longest in the trilogy. I'm actually not 100% certain on that. I think there's one nasty boy in The Last Argument of Kings, but I don't know if it's even this long.
Can we search through it and find it?
No. This isn't an episode of Dark Matter.
True.
But we'll kick it off by going to Holding the Line. So on our morning of battle here, we're met immediately by our familiar Union faces at Lord Marshall's command post. Colonel West, Captain Jalenhorm, the newly appointed Sergeant Pike, watching over General Croy's division advance kind of in battle order. They're beginning to kind of separate out the different forces. As we know, Polder's troops are doing the same on the flank, that sort of horse flank that's eventually going to strike from the edge. And Lord Marshal Burr emerges from that tent, and his innards are producing sour burps, and it's just the same, you know, the same sort of thing.
Same silly, long-standing quirk of the character. Nothing new here. Damn indigestion.
Yeah, just indigestion. That's all it's ever been, you know, since we met him to begin with. It's just been indigestion, not maybe cancer or some other serious disease that is killing this man. Mm.
Looking back on it, though. Mm-hmm. It has been getting worse.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been advancing. I just like, I found this to be like a funny thing that like you didn't point to in any context for the most part. You're just like, yeah, he's just, you know, like you didn't. Yeah.
Because it's been so present.
Yeah, it's innocuous almost.
And we like it's just a part of the other like really intense things going on. So it's hard to like stop and dwell on that. I don't know. I had initially been wary of it and like curious about it, and then eventually it just kind of fell off my radar. It became innocuous enough. It became normal enough. Even as it got worse, but that's all with hindsight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is, right? And so that was kind of the thing. I'm always curious, especially in different books, right? You pick up on different things and you kind of track different things. And this is one of those that I was like, I was interested in the fact that you like didn't latch into quite as aggressively as you have some other ideas or theories, or like, you know, by comparison, like why, right? And sort of your thoughts there, you know, this is one that that's I was true. Like, I wonder if.
But even so, even if I had, the payoff would have been, ha, look, it did come back to, like, it was worse than he was claiming to be, but we still don't know anything about it, you know? We don't truly know the source of it.
I guess I wasn't even necessarily trying to point to, like, needing to know, like, the source or the truth of it or what have you, but just, like, an idea.
I'm just thinking of, like, what I would have been thinking if I had, like, laser focused on it. Like, oh, yeah, ha, it's something. Okay.
Fair enough. You know, what is that going to mean for whatever moment? Mm-hmm. Cool. So, you know, the men eventually advance, of course, and Jalen Horm immediately spies the North lining up just as orderly as the King's Own, but that's like kind of crazy to him. He sees the different ranks as well as they're beginning to form, can clearly see the breakdown of what he assumes are the named men, and otherwise he doesn't see any cavalry, of course, mounting, which he assumes is going to be a component that will strike at Croy's troops perhaps later or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that lack of cavalry was an oh shit moment for me.
Like, yeah.
Oh no.
Oh, we've been here before. Which is also the you know, I don't want to like layer it in fully as like PTSD, but the stress that he feels in the moment of like, I've seen this happen before. This is happening again. Could this be happening? And sort of that panic that builds up in him.
Rightfully. Like, accurately. Mm-hmm. Trust your gut, West, for the most part.
Well, yeah, don't trust Burr's gut for sure.
No, never. This having happened before that he's talking about being Ladislaw's sort of battle, literally feels very similar here too, being that it feels very unique to have a battle scene from afar, from like the commander's perspective, looking through sight glasses and seeing how it's all unfolding. I'm sure there's plenty of examples of battles unfolding like this in literature, but this is fairly new to me. I'm sure there's some in like Lord of the Rings that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. But I like this perspective a little bit, the sort of overview look at the battle.
Yeah, Joe said in a couple of different interviews that he's a big fan of 4X games. Like, he absolutely loves Civ and the Total War series and plays the ever-living hell out of both of them. So I think that that's just a great sort of mentality or approach that he's had, at the very least in these early novels, towards those sort of battle scenes and sequences and like giving us a different idea, a different look, which is not oft mimicked because it doesn't possess the same sort of action that, you know, being up close in the combat does. Instead, he mixes those two things, though, in this one, which is what makes it so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get both through this chapter. Great. Terrible, but it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is absolutely terrible. So moving forward from there, in Polder's line on the high ridge, the Union doesn't seem to want the Northmen's help in their deployment. So Three Trees is kind of allowed to be immediately more safe. They're worried about maybe a small incursion of betrayal, so they're allowed to kind of settle in the trees above, kind of out of sight. Although everyone seems kind of mystified by Three Trees' caution of this whole thing, because it seems like they should be prepared. You know, they obey. Dogman makes a fire because he believes that to be sensible, especially in the cold, with Cathill here. He finds some eggs, or he has some eggs, which is the first time in a long time that he says that he's had eggs or anything. Yeah. You know, it's ridiculous. He gives them to, he begins cooking them, hands them to Cathil, smelling something, and moves to the edge of the camp. The Northmen quickly recognize that Dogman being onto something is, you know, a thing, and then move from there.
Yeah. Those damn eggs are going to haunt Dogman for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Two eggs.
Five
eggs,
right?
Do you think it was the eggs?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, that's not what brought them in, but that's what killed Cathil.
Yeah, right. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Because if the eggs hadn't been finished cooking, she wouldn't have popped up and yelled, "The eggs are done," and been in the line of fire.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that that will haunt Dogman?
That's a good question. I don't think so. No, I know I put down some thoughts on the Northmen's sensibilities around death, and I don't think it will. I don't think he'll linger on it.
Yeah. I think haunt is too aggressive, and even like something like ruminate, right? Like, I think that he will recall and like it won't leave him, but it's not something that will keep him up constantly at night. It's like any other loss in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's spoken to pretty highly, or more specifically, I should say, in the very end of the book. And so when we get there, we can kind of address that directly with what he says over her grave versus three trees. Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate as well. So obviously this loose arrow finds its way into Cathil's side, and we get this very intense scene that happens as Dogman tries to sort of rescue her by and large with the arrow between the ribs, where Three Trees also tries to immediately assist, trying to treat the wound by pulling the arrow back out, which of course we know to be a bad thing. They can't get it back out, so then they push it through the other side, which is just sort of horrifying on the whole, and it's difficult to kind of deal with.
I'm just trying to like think about it from Cathil's perspective, where like she gets pulled out of harm's way initially, but then they all go back out and like fight for a while.
Like, yeah.
She's sitting there for quite a long time
without they kill intervention Shanka by the dozens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And just the like her protesting and kicking and flailing and in very obvious excruciating pain before passing out as they're pushing the fucking arrow through. It's like, that sucks. But the heartbreaking part is just the nice and warm refrain from Dogman as he's like tucking her into his blanket and like making her comfortable and like hoping she'll get out of the cold and she's gone. It's vivid and
keep you warm, eh? Nice and warm.
Nice and warm.
Yeah. Keep it's just warm.
Beautiful, but fucking awful.
In particular, to your point of beautiful but fucking awful, it is, there's a deep tragedy there. And then the line that he uses right after, the two-line pair, is just so simple as he realizes that, as Three Trees says, she's dead. He says, what? And then immediately following that, as white specks drifted down around them, it was starting to snow again. And it's just this cold indifference that the world has to these different sorts of tragedies as they occur, right? And I think literally cold in the case of this winter snowfall.
Yep. Back to the mud.
Back to the mud. Ugh.
We'll drink for it.
What a phrase. Cheers to Cathil. Drink for Cathil.
I'm sure we'll drink again at her funeral, but
we definitely will. And we cheers right at the beginning. So
damn it. He deserves it. She was good.
Yeah, she was a great character. The combat, though, with the Shanka is incredible, you know, and I think what I really appreciate about it as well is this is the first time that we've gotten a description outside of, well, we did get Jizal's, but this is the first time that we've gotten another Northman's kind of take on sort of the look of these things. And so we get the idea of like, they are so differently and malformed and malcreated. Like, these are, by and large, by my understanding, I don't know your interpretation, but all these things seem to be rush jobs. Like, just crank them out, get them out there, you know, malformed things.
Yeah, I mean, maybe rush jobs, but also think about like the majority of their like malformalities compared to humans are in like the top of the head area. They don't really need brains.
Well, and
like
limbs
we have.
Are a different size.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
true.
One arm is longer than the other. Like,
no, that's a good
they're
point.
They're not symmetrical.
Yeah,
that could be the waste, or that could be like time, you know, and the impact that it's had on them as well. But yeah,
yeah. Who knows? I don't know. That's a good point, though. Like, these were born out of necessity. These were built as an army. They don't need to be built perfect. I think the entire point was overcome them with numbers, I think. It seemed like. So, but yeah, it was cool to get another physical description of them where Jizal's was the first.
Yeah, like we get a rough idea just from, you know, the very first time with the Logan, but like he doesn't really get into it because he knows what a flathead looks like. Mm-hmm. And then Jizal has never seen these things before. Meanwhile, Dogman notes these as notable in the way that they're misshapen and likely from across or further up north or what have you. So, But the smell is the same.
That smells the same. Could that mean that they're produced by someone else?
Don't know. Do you think so?
New version, a worse version, the knockoff version of Shanka.
Yeah, yeah. There's the question of like, there. I think that there's this possibility, like you're saying, that these are new Shanka. There's also like, is this, were they like with planned obsolescence created? You know, like, is that like a part of this? Like they're just gradually breaking down over time, you know, too.
Maybe.
So, yeah.
I mean, we're dealing on a time scale of hundreds of years. So it could just be like, that's what time does to these things. It doesn't.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're obviously, given what we know about the ones that are in Alcus, they're able to pick at the bones for like ever of things, and you know, flesh there doesn't rot, so they're able to feed on those things forever. So, yeah, tough to make that call or like figure that out. It's an interesting mythological note inside of here of like, what
if they feed,
really?
Do they poop?
One assumes.
What does Shanka poop look like?
Maybe the reason that Shanka are all weird and deformed is because they reproduce via pooping. I'm not convinced.
I'm not either.
So moving back to the command post, Burr and West are shouting and yelling and cursing at Polder's failure to engage as Croy's men are hard pressed. Burr dispatches a runner as all of these different pieces of information come in. The stress continues to mount and there's this concern that West is going to have to commit the cavalry too soon. But before the marshal manages to continue, he, inside of his tent, jerks over the top of the table and spews black bile all over the tabletop, splattering on the maps. West quickly catches him, manages to prop him up, and there is some debate over what should be done with him between West and Jalenhorm. What do you make of this turn with Burr becoming incapacitated?
Yeah, I think West had the right idea, what he decides to do to stop Jalenhorm from reaching out to the doctor. It's a fair point.
And it is what you said, we can't lose, you know?
Yeah, we can't let this fail. Or can't be allowed to fail. I think that was the exact term. God, it's a bold move. And he even recognizes that he's like flirting with treason in this moment.
But he's already done that once.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
What's the second bout of treason? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Some light treason needs to be paired with more treason. Yeah, I think ultimately he made the right move because I think, God, just how petty and horrible the two generals are, Croy and Polder. I could see this getting in the way of the battle plan. Like they don't understand. They're so fucking mad with each other even at the end of all this. Like they clearly would let the other like fail or seize control themselves if they thought that there was a power vacuum, even in this like really intense moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It feels incredibly likely, especially between Croy and Poulder and their sort of massive personalities, that they would absolutely let the lives of thousands of men, as Gjallarhorn say, outweigh the needs of saving as many people as possible, right?
Yeah.
Like, losing Croy's division doesn't really matter, given their sort of competitive nature, and it feels more reminiscent. The pair of Croy and Poulder, despite their competency, seems closer to, like, the sort of leadership style of Ladislaw and his coterie than, you know, their own.
And I don't think either of them would abandon, like, the battle, but they would hastily appoint one of their staffers to their position, and then they would like leave and take up Burr's position. But both of them would do it, and neither of their armies would be well like led, and they would both fail, and then they'd both be fighting, and it wouldn't have worked properly.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I have to back up a little bit, and Krolder is definitely their ship name, right?
Krolder? Yeah, absolutely. Krolder. Or Proil.
Proy.
Proy, yeah. Proy's not bad. I think Krolder was better, though.
Krolder?
Krolder. Yeah, Krolder. Wow, what a bit. I do want to get into the Gjallarhorn bit, the confrontation that happens here, though. So there's the, listen to me, we must follow through with this plan. We must, and then who must? Me and you alone, if that's what it takes, but this is a man's life. And then West replies, this is a thousand men's life. And then proceeds to maybe a step away from like high-level blackmail his like best friend or guilt him. Not his best friend, but a close friend. Absolute guilt trip of, you should be dead, but I let you live, in the moment to get him to do what he needs. What was your take on West's move here?
Imagine on the screen a little frowny face, and Gjallarhorn will remember this. this is stressing this relationship quite a bit. Even West recognizes that this isn't something good to do. This isn't something that he wants to do in this moment, but it's necessary. Like he needs to flex the sort of he needs to utilize all the goodwill that he's banked. He needs to spend it here. And he spends it brutishly. But I can't think of a way that he could say this without it coming across as, it's not even blackmail. I guess there's like a veiled threat inside of it, but I don't know what, it's just saying like, you fucking owe me, basically. It's cashing in his chips. Would you consider it blackmail? Like what? Where would this fall?
That's why I was kind of like skirting around it. It's guilt. This is totally like levying guilt against him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's still like a realization, kind of like you said, like Gjallarhorn will remember this. You know, they're no longer just friends playing cards. But then again, this is Gjallarhorn's first taste of battle, really. I mean, he might have been in a couple of skirmishes since, you know, their deployment maybe, but this is the first like real combat. And by comparison, West has served already, and so like understands that line of difference. So maybe it's just a matter of, he may have been too comfortable with everyone before too, you know, beneath mm-hmm. him. But yeah, tough spot to be in. What'd you think of calling upon Pike in his sort of action as he stands up over the course of this chapter?
I don't know if he really needed to call upon Pike. Pike just seems like someone that would have done this anyway.
Well, he just had to tell him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he just
true.
Says it once. He doesn't have to repeat himself. And he's like, under any circumstances. And immediately,
Pike doesn't even know what's going on.
Yeah.
He still resorts to like threatening a superior officer with violence.
Yeah.
On multiple occasions. One notable occasion, but like,
he still
truly
looks scary. Yeah.
He does look scary. The faceless man. And the general
the fact
stare
that
against
described as a faceless man is a lot as well. Like, oh boy. Oh boy. Yeah,
do you
not
think
only
West
that,
would recognize like, him if he had his face still?
That's a great question for you, PJ. Do you think he'll recognize
no,
it
probably
if he
not.
Has his face?
I don't think. I think they would. Yeah. I think they would have figured out who each other were by now if they. He would, if he recognized his face, he would have remembered his name too.
Right, for sure, for sure.
Unless the name is.
I feel like you just like wormed your way back into a hole.
Is this Colonel Glockta?
Yes. There's actually a time dilation thing going on here. Also, his leg works and he's got teeth.
Yeah, but I mean, that's that Glockta. This is a different Glockta that we're talking
about. No, I appreciate that kind of line. I just find it fascinating that so quickly Pike goes from, you know, supervising and otherwise into guard dog mode, basically at a blow of a whistle, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's his man. He's Westman.
He is Westman through and through. That should be clear to fucking everyone at this point. Yeah, so of course we commit the reserves and quickly West actually turns this into his turn to lead, which is kind of a different thing as well, where he is making a lot of decisions and proves himself incredibly capable, actually, with sort of a swell of false confidence without bravado necessarily. And false confidence might even be selling it incorrectly, but you know, he's got kind of a swell underneath him in what needs to be done in order to keep everyone else alive, and manages incredibly well considering his two competing commanders.
I think false confidence works here.
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily falls into the traditional definition of false confidence, but it is like he has to put on the face of confidence in order to sell this, and he's not necessarily confident that he can actually pull it off.
Yeah, closer to like the like confidence man definition of like con man, right? Like it's that sort of confidence, more of an older English term usage. But yeah.
Good.
Yeah, he sells it well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When we return then, immediately cutting from sort of the battle and the actionable decisions to the dogman and everyone else waiting up in the tree line for Shanka attacks. They come multiple times and they're repelled repeatedly, but the defense on their side is thinning. They've been slowly losing some of the carls of Shivers' men. Dogman sees that Shanka are waiting and that he finds that strange because Shanka never wait. Dogman frowns once again as a new smell touches his nose, as the mist rises and Shiver begins to panic, feeling this sort of sinking dread in them all, understanding that what is about to happen is about to be terrifying, as from the summoned mist, a figure too large to fathom, even bigger than Tul Duru Thunderhead, emerges, and it is our half armor clad Fenris the Feared, wearing strictly armor on just half of his body, the other half covered in the blue runic tattoos, as we have seen him previously when he screamed Angland and freaked us all the way back in book one. What do you make of this charge then, the three trees and everyone else, and sort of this this moment, as it were?
And I had been excitedly dreading the reappearance of the Feared. What a fucking monster. I don't know what to attribute to, like, especially with the appearance of the mist and the understanding of sort of the weird magical effects going on within this battle, and the sorceress or witch or whatever they want to call her. The mist coming in is clearly magical because it shouldn't happen this high up and it shouldn't happen this time of day and all this kind of stuff. And we've already talked about how the sorceress brings on the mist. But I'm curious if the fear itself that's racking the ranks of the troops and Shivers and all the men, if this response is just actual fear of circumstances, or if there's something magically compelling them to be afraid of this visage, who is, to be fair, fucking terrifying. Like, I'm right. not going to deny that, but it takes a lot of will, especially for these really hardened soldiers to force themselves to go through this attack. I'm leaning towards magical fear effect.
Got it. Okay. So magically enchanting sort of the fear as a part of the mist. Is that kind of your assumption there?
I'm not necessarily thinking it's a part of the mist, but knowing that the mist is in this area, it makes sense to me that other types of magic could also be in this area right now too. Because okay. I feel like Jazal felt an unnatural sense of fear when the fear had walked into that hall as well. I can't recall specifically, but that rings a bell for me.
Yeah, there did seem to be something there at the very least. Whether or not that was magical or not, good question.
Right. I think we talked about that.
Interesting and interestinger. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Interesting and interestinger.
Yeah. That said, I love Three Trees rallying all the people together before this charge, you know, and like getting the bravado up, like steady lads. And, you know, one of the people shrilly shouts or like is like freaking out about the fact that it's feared, and fucking Shivers shuts him down, you know,
mm-hmm.
Shut your fucking hole. Just so good as they prepare arrows and just like unleash on him. As the Flatheads also come out of the mist, Grim mutters fuck, which again, very occasionally talks. That's a great send off for the combat as it's about to happen, as the charge begins from Three Trees right then and there.
This is why Three Trees is, and always will be, our leader for the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Nothing will ever happen to him. He'll be a steadfast leader until the end of his days.
Oh, no. Yeah. There's a severe amount of doubt, of course, in what's about to happen. You know, whether or not, you know, even Dogman himself is going to throw himself into the combat, and all of the group go. There's this lovely little line where Shivers whispers to Dogman, "Do I go on three or after three?" It harkens back again to like Dogman not knowing what the signal is. And he's like, he doesn't even really know. He's like, doesn't really matter as long as you go. Just like a nice little
true. Like, especially when you're dealing with like it's not a moment of surprise. It's just a mm-hmm. like let's fucking go kind of deal.
Yeah. And the amount of adrenaline that Joe fits in between the count as Three Trees does it as well. From Dogman's perspective, it's one already, you know, and there's like all that tension.
Uh-huh. I like
it's almost time to go. Yeah.
I love the it's one already call.
Yeah.
Made me laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of these, it's just so good. And then obviously there's a wonderful, magnificent combat scene as, you know, Dogman takes off a number of folks. They're taking off as many people as they can, throwing a spear at people. Just so many good combat moments that happen here that lend itself to, as I imagine, just an absolutely incredible moment in a show. So
in a show
or movie.
Oh yeah.
In adaptation. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant
like on the page. It's incredible for sure. Yeah, yeah. No, in the book, it's fantastic. I just mean in adaptation, my brain immediately went to, this will be a glorious battle.
Yeah, this will be really fucking good. Mm. This chapter is a whole episode. Like this chapter alone is one episode of the show. If it's a show.
Yeah. Right.
Or it's a whole
absolutely
movie
is.
If it's a series of movies.
Fair. I mean, it absolutely could be a whole movie in some ways. And yeah, just the picture in which I could read a whole book about, you know, a battle from Joe's perspective. You know what I mean? Like given all this sort of political drama and everything else, and like sort of setting up all the puzzle pieces and seeing them fall mm-hmm. in place is just incredible.
Multiple perspectives, front lines, sidelines, overview, stuff like that could be really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But getting to the battle itself, of course, a number of flatheads fall. Dogman goes up against the Fuhrer on his own. He doesn't make it. He quickly gets kind of just swatted away and then, you know, injured pretty readily. Three Trees jumps out of absolutely nowhere, slamming a shield into the giant. The old warrior tries so hard, but the Fuhrer just crunches him into the turf. I believe grabbing him, I mean, just in so many ways, breaking him just simply with his fists, which is a lot to watch our captain, our chief go through.
And I mean, it's just his fists, quote unquote, but they're like gauntleted, right? Like he's got like armor cladding on like the fronts of his hands, I think. So it's not nothing. But still,
yeah,
it's right. Still, he punched him to death. He squished him with fingers.
Yeah. And he also like ripped apart the dude's shield with his hands, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And that great hand dropped his shield down and crunched into Three Trees' ribs with a sound like dry sticks breaking, you know, like, is that the shield? Is that the ribs?
It's,
you know,
probably it's a little bit of both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's aggressive and terrifying.
Yeah.
Red blood on blue knuckles. Yeah. A lot there. But then quickly, Shivers is able to throw a spear at him as he's coming out from the moment, you know, jabs at him. And this quickly leads also to Tull and Dao jumping on the giant, basically, to try to knock him back as best as they can. They're not leaving any wounds on the exposed part of the flesh where they're attacking, and realizing that this is failing, of course. It doesn't seem to be doing much outside of physically moving him away, kind of like poking a giant, you know, like shoving an insect out of a house with a broom, you know, like,
yeah,
they're doing much more than that.
Yeah. I don't get it. Cause he like this drives him away seemingly, and maybe something else does. I think simultaneously, like, the mist is receding a little bit. Or no, the mist recedes as a response to him fleeing. I don't get what caused him to retreat, because he seemed perfectly capable of, like, smooshing all of these guys until they were just putty. I'm still trying to figure out why he decided to abandon the battle.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. He definitely backed out, though.
Could be an amount of time thing. Could be something like the Bloody Nine. When he recedes, he's done. But he doesn't seem to recede when the battle's still going on, as far as we've been able to tell. I don't know.
Yeah. Tough to point to what exactly that could be, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so sorry, PJ. I have the answer, and I cannot.
I know you do. It's fine. But all of this is distracting us from the fact that Three Trees is dead.
Yeah. And that like moment and reveal is so upsetting as Dogman, you know, as he basically calls out for, you know, him. He's like, listen to me, Dogman, listen. And he says, what, chief?
No.
And he never finishes.
I know. He's fucking listening. Just say it. You don't have to preamble that. Dogman listens. Yeah. He's got dog ears. He listens so well. He's such a good listener. He's got a good nose. He's got good ears. It's all good. Just say the thing and Dogman will hear.
Grim, again, the man of few words, says back to the mud.
Cheers to Three Trees.
Cheers once again to Three Trees. All right. So rounding out the end of this incredible chapter is our return to the Union camp. The battle over, seemingly having been one, I mean, the Union wasn't overtaken. There was a withdrawal of sorts. It's unclear whether or not anyone would call this a victory, I think, on either side of the forces. But Croy returns having taken heavy losses, but forcing Bethod's retreat, which I guess you could call a victory. And Polder comes in from the flanks carrying a corpse of Ashanka as evidence of his men after there's finger pointing at each other, saying that neither contributed to the combat, leading them to sort of escalate to a demand to see Burr to have this sorted out, and a very scared West kind of practically pissing his pants.
Yeah, hard to call it a victory, but not too hard for, I think it's Pike that launches this like clapping match, but it's, God, it was so smart of Polder to bring the Shanka. And I was curious why they were doing that until I remembered that Jazal had like excused it as folklore initially. So like they had never seen anything like this before. So of course they'll bring a specimen back as proof. West fucking pulled it off in the end. Not alone. Pike did a lot of heavy lifting. Jalen Horm did a lot of staying quiet. And ultimately Burr reemerges as a fucking corpse,
but alive,
yeah. But not quite a corpse. Yeah. There were some close fucking calls there. I did love that clapping match between the idiot generals though. Like that felt good.
It's so good as it's like, yes, please applaud our, you know, our general.
It's customary to congratulate our Lord Marshall in a victory.
Yeah. And it is West that starts the whole thing, but Pike and Jalen Horm immediately clap.
Oh, that's okay.
His little dogs on a chain clap for him in support immediately, given all the things that happened. And I think, you know, there's something to be read into at the very least, or maybe I especially like the comparisons of Pike and Jalen Horm versus Polder and Croy. It's not lost on me the sort of closeness of those names in a lot of cases, but the difference here with like Pike's loyalty being absolute without questions and Jalen Horm's being this sort of like guilt and friendship and seeing that West's plan worked and everything turned out for the better nonetheless, I think is like completely subtextual, but is just kind of inspiring in a way, you know, yeah. You have to imagine for his character at the end here.
Totally. I'm curious how long Jalen Horm stays. I imagine he'll stay friendly like this until the end of this battle, but I'm curious if this strained their relationship enough to like not let them interact so much after the war is done, if they survive it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Who knows? I knows.
I know knows. He knows.
Most of the listeners knows.
Hi, most, listeners.
Not all. All right, PJ, anything else on this absolutely massive chapter?
Probably, but not that I can think of right now. It's pretty fucking massive, and we covered a lot. It really, like I said at the top of the show, like it felt like three chapters.
Yeah. And I mean, to even cover it in this way with like so much of it summarized in its own right, again, thank you to the First Law Wiki. We needed to turn this one around a little bit quicker just due to some schedule things. And so they helped out in particular with this chapter. The rest are, of course, but yeah, cool. All right, PJ, with that, we get into the drink segment. What are you drinking tonight?
One chapter and we're into the drink segment? What is this?
Yeah, because there's three chapters on the other side and three chapters on this side, PJ. Right.
Yep.
How are you confused?
That's right. I am drinking, for my cocktail, just a bog standard margarita.
Ooh.
So 3-2-2 ratio. So 1.5 ounces of tequila, 1 ounce of orange liqueur, and 1 ounce of lime juice. For the tequila, I used Teremana Reposado. And for the orange liqueur, I used Duao orange liqueur because I was curious about it. It was like half the price of Cointreau, which is what I usually go for. So
you don't rock a dry Curacao instead?
I can't find it anywhere around here.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, I'm sure if I went into Minneapolis, I could like source it, but none of the liquor stores around here or in St. Cloud carry it. But when I have it, that's what I use.
Yeah,
but
yeah, sure.
I feel like Cointreau is the best replacement of that. But this is just a pretty standard kind of sugary, sweet, like syrupy orange liqueur, and it's fine. I thought maybe I'd have something more fun to say about it, but it does the job, and it's pretty cheap. So yeah, overall, a standard, nice margarita. But 1 second, I've got to grab this out of... I have a, like, Yeti pint cooler thing, like a can koozie thing that keeps things cold. But I don't have it for a 12-ounce, so... Like an hour before, and I brought this up early, and I put it in my ice maker that I have in my office. And I just turned on the ice maker and let it stay chilled in there. So I had to go grab
it. Nice.
But this is from Dangerous Man Brewing Company, their Peach Citrus Sour, 6% alcohol by volume, fruity, hoppy, tart, sour ale. Haven't tried it before. I had a friend that came to a pizza party that I threw. That traded me a handful of cans of beer for a big jug of the beer that I brewed. So yeah, I'm excited to give it a try. Dangerous Man was a long like mainstay of Minneapolis, and they recently closed their Minneapolis taproom. But their manufacturing facility, their distribution center, is the next town over for me. And they're going to be opening a tap room there soon. So I'm excited to get some more Dangerous Man in the future.
Very exciting. I love Dangerous Man. Which was it again? One more time. Sorry.
The Peach Citrus Sour.
Ah, that sounds delicious. I've traditionally loved their... They've had a number of good beers over the year, of course. Their Peanut Butter Porter, of course, is notable. A lot of people love that and get that. I'm sure that's one that they can distribute. I'd be shocked if it wasn't. But they've done a number of like great... grapefruit IPAs or grapefruit forward beers over the year, and some I'm lifelong fan of grapefruit in beer and grapefruit in general. I don't think you can ever overdo it. However, some people can make it super cloying and it's not that great. Theirs is one of the best grapefruit beers that I've had.
Theirs is really good. That's true.
I believe it's I believe they've done a rotation of like Goza sour and IPA, but yeah.
So I just cracked this and tasted it. It sits kind of, so there's like sours and there's IPAs and then there are sour IPAs, and this like sits between all three of them because it's not as sour as a sour. It's not as like bitter or hop forward as an IPA, and it doesn't quite hit like both of those. It's like a light version of a sour IPA. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm.
Interesting. Yeah. Sounds tasty.
Should be. So, what about you, Crossland? What are you drinking? I know you worked hard on this one. Not today, but over the weekend.
Yeah. I am having a clarified Mai Tai, another coconut clarified cocktail. I made both a coconut clarified Mai Tai and a coconut clarified margarita over the weekend for my brother's girlfriend's birthday, basically just a party that we were having, and wanted to, you know, have that kind of readily available and whatnot. So made a couple of like basically ready to go cocktails, and they were great to serve. The nice thing about the clarification process too is like it incorporates everything together real nicely, as it strips out a lot of those things that would create different gravity and separation, and it like doesn't separate, which was awesome. So yeah, it's just delicious.
Nice. I'm excited to try that sometime. I need to do that soon.
Yeah, it's really not that bad. I thought it was, you know, especially after having done it once before, expectations adjusted, understanding timelines, you know, the longer you can let it go, the better. Honestly, I also did the Mai Tai twice, and I would definitely recommend that on the whole. Again, just kind of a bog standard, like you were saying, bog standard margarita. This is a bog standard Mai Tai, just clarified with coconut. No, nothing crazy.
Cool.
Yeah. So. It's the 1-1-1 ratio lime syrup for anyone looking online. It's fucking amazing, though. And also, like, just a pourable cocktail. This is the last of it that I saved, basically, for this episode.
Hmm.
And it's so fucking good. Following that up, I believe I had this last week on the show, as they had just bottled it for the first time. But One Small Step from Mankind Brewing. Did I have this last week? I think I did. Didn't I show you the can art?
Maybe.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm high.
You could have.
I really don't remember on that side of things. But when did we record? What day did we record last week?
Wednesday?
I don't think so. I think I got this on Friday. But yeah. Anyway, But it's very good. It's an IPA. I've had it on the show before, technically in crowler form. I haven't had it in the new canned form, of which they just released about 2 weeks ago. I love the can art. It is very cool and very sick. It's a West Coast IPA with your favorite hop, Amarillo, and Citra.
All right.
I'm telling you, man, I think there's something that they do down here making them that makes them so prevalent, but also not at all the same, not overbearing. It could be the water profile. It could be all kinds of things.
Could be a lot of stuff.
Because I get no grass clipping. Unlike your silly ass.
Could just be me. No, you get it when...
Yeah, I get it on some things. I'm more tolerant of it than you are on the things where it's there, but it is not present on a lot of beers in town that have it. Although New Anthem closed, so rip.
Yeah. Could be, I mean, it could be a whole lot of stuff, but it could be the water.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with that, we'll get into a fitting punishment. Ah, man, this chapter I both like love and loathe, but we open up this chapter with a crowd waiting to execute Ambassador Tulkas, of whom we'd talked about a little bit last week. And just the description that Glockta gives Artie, I think, is just haunting of what is about to happen to this man. The pair of them throughout the execution seem to be on that level, like we said last week. They're both kind of curious about the truth. And also there's this sort of, as we said last week, it's not necessarily like there's any flirtation going on, but there's like an intellectual volleying that's happening back and forth between them that is mutually fascinating, that they appreciate. Like they're kind of toying with each other, but not in any way that is... There's no attraction undertones or like relationship undertones.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's not like overt flirting in any sense.
Right. Right. Glockta again has many excellent quotes throughout this entire section, but I would love to kick it off with a great one here that I really appreciate from this perspective. He says, "It's a curiosity, but you always get a good showing for an execution. People love to see death. It reminds them that however mean, however low, however horrible their lives become, at least they have one." And,
it's a good point. I think it's reasonable. I think it's probably true for the most part. But I can think of so many additional reasons why people would be compelled to attend an execution. I think there's morbid curiosity. There's one. Sheer entertainment, which is dark but true. FOMO, as people are susceptible to. But there's also just disgust at the notion of it. And the idea that refusing to attend could create an apathy towards it and towards the injustice taking place or towards the horror taking place. So like even the people that are vehemently against public executions are probably still in attendance, I would assume. At least some of them. Maybe not. I'm sure I am trivializing it a little bit and pointing to extremes. Like I'm like most people live in the middle of things. Like they're most people maybe don't feel so compelled to attend something that they're abhorred by or that abhors them. But I'm sure there's a decent number of people that would feel like they would slip into apathy if they weren't constantly reminded of horrors that are taking place under their nose that they disagree with.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely people that are going to be disgusted, right? But there is this element at the very least of the worst sort of variety of people at no matter what a base level, right? Like at the basest level, this is an understanding that they're still alive. And I think that's what he's pointing to. But all of the rest of it, I think you're 100% there on as well. Like, I'm not suggesting necessarily that there are outright good people in this world or maybe goodness isn't rewarded in a lot of ways. But that isn't to say that there aren't decent people. We know plenty of decent characters.
Yeah,
but yeah.
I would argue Artie is a good example of this. I think she's a decent character. I think she's a decent person. And I don't think she's particularly excited about this public execution, but she's still in attendance.
Right.
Like, yeah. she's pretty horrified by what she's seeing and what's being laid out in front of her.
But yeah.
She's still here.
Right. And potentially
she dragged along, I guess. She right. got brought, but...
Yeah. 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 Very, very good point. Though on the whole, I mean, just like, you know, to the point of bringing up RD2 as a conflicting factor, you know, she's here and she's not that way. So, although in a callous way, she is also that has that same sort of baser thing going on at the very least.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beat Fallow's face in with her foot.
Yep. Yep. So during this conversation that's happening, of course, Severard walks up just after he finishes his point with Artie about before the execution and explains that he had followed Vitari and found out that she has a family in town and what she's been protecting and that's what she's been protecting as her secret. In addition, he's unable to find additional information on the Prince's Guard as he appears to have gone missing the day before, according to his family. So there's a couple of like interesting little notes tucked in here. Severard was sent on a distinct mission and not just dismissed out of hand last week.
Yeah. Before we get into that, I do want to approach that final bit of conversation with Artie because it's kind of curious to me. Specifically, Glockta is explaining his doubts in the certainty of guilt that has been attributed to Tulkas. And he goes about and like, I'm curious about how casual he is in just kind of dropping that information on Artie, but also how he's doing it in such a public place instead of like later on at her home. But that said, it creates for this really, I don't want to call it nice, but a unified viewing between the two of them of the end of this execution, sharing this understanding and realizing that everything being presented to the people isn't necessarily the full truth. I kind of appreciated that. But back at the matter at hand, Vitari is a mom. That feels pretty interesting. I don't remember being given an explicit rules of practicalism or practicality or whatever you want to call them, if that got set forward for us, but context clues, it feels like this isn't allowed or is at the very least frowned upon, given the way this conversation between Glockta and Severard happens in sort of tense, harshed tones. But I don't know, was there any sort of, like, they're not celibate because Severard fucks anything that moves that he's allowed to pay for. No one bats an eye at that, but having a family is across the line, I guess.
It just seems like an odd business for a torturer, right? Like,
that's fair. Know. It definitely seems odd.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that this conversation happens, it makes it feel at the very least taboo and almost illegal or against their code of conduct.
Yeah. Yeah. At the very least, it makes it seem as though I feel like taboo is the right term, right? Like you're saying, it makes it feel as though there are rules that we don't know about the Inquisition necessarily. Mm-hmm. Or the other side of this is that potentially the problem with having a family is that it's leverage against you. And like, that's a fear in general inside of the Inquisition or against being a member of the Inquisition to have something that could be leveraged against you, you know?
Yeah. Right. That makes sense.
There, I think that there are layers of questions here as far as that goes. But regardless, I think all of them potentially apply, you know, at this point.
Right.
Vitari and her family are unconventional, to say the least.
How long were they in?
Like, the Archlector doesn't have a family.
Well, do we know that for sure?
At the very least, we don't know of them.
Yeah.
If he does.
Glockta's got a mom.
Glockta does have a mom.
Does that count as family?
I mean, of course it does, but like, you know.
I know.
Salt has never once spoken about a wife, for instance.
That's true. Salt doesn't really talk about anything other than the immediacy of his of the task at hand.
I mean, and maybe the reality is that I'm not giving Salt enough credit here, and he like is just like an absolute Rene Brown warrior of whom creates that 40-hour a week boundary in his life where like he doesn't work more than the 40. He doesn't take his work home with him to his wife and kids, you know. He just has that separation, that notion.
I mean, there are some terrible people that have wives and kids and husbands and families.
Yeah. Also a fair point. So leaving the execution and execution hanging is maybe putting it lightly. This is a disembowelment. Although Before They Are Disemboweled would probably be not as good of a book title.
You know? Yeah.
Not as marketable.
I don't, you know what? I think it would have worked fine.
It's also not the quote, but yeah, sure.
You're right. Right.
Yeah. But moving on from Tulkas and sort of that execution and really the instigation of a war that we can see coming in the distance for the Union with the South as well. We then come to a conversation between Glockta and Ardy back at her place, equipped with Fallow's new lovely digs setting up the whole space. But it centers around the plan of succession and how it relies on the Open Council's decision. It seems likely that a number of our recurring Opal Council characters are going to be up for consideration for new king should the old king die, including Lord Brock, Barazin, Hugin, Usher, and Scald. There's a lot of different options that are kind of presented. I'm curious on your sort of thoughts, as it were.
I thought for sure we were going, like, the path of our conversation, I thought we were going towards already recommending Glockta for running for king, but that didn't happen. What did happen is that she parroted a lot of the names that we heard Salt talk about in the previous chapter, or in the previous section, and it gets me kind of excited about the idea of having Ardy at Glockta's side, if that ends up happening, for matters of court, because she's got a brain for it, it seems like.
Yeah, she does seem to be more than her station in a lot of ways, as she pours herself a cup of wine, prevents herself from pouring a cup of wine, actually, and then when Malthus arrives, pours herself a cup of wine to deal with it. Yeah,
understandable.
Drink for the wine. Yeah. She definitely does have a mind for it and understands more of the intricacies. She's not simple by any stretch. Neither of us have ever implied that either.
No.
But, like, you know, it's definitely continually proven to not be the case.
No, I mean specifically, like, understanding the niches in which her brain focuses on. I'm excited to see that play out because it's going to become a very important part of Glockta's story, I think.
Okay. Cool. All right. And then our kind of final beat for Glockta here of the story. Malthus arrives from Valant in bulk, requiring that the man stop his investigation into the death of the late prince. In the end, after much contemplation, he agrees, understanding himself to have been purchased as a part of the prior agreement with V and B. And thus ends our portion of Glockta's story for this book.
Malthus is... I don't know what to make of him because he's kind of reduced to a scared lackey in this moment, the way that Glockta sees him. But seems like a pretty smart move on Glockta's part, recognizing that it's not just his life at risk, it's Malthus's as well, which is maybe not actually very heavy of a weight in Glockta's decision making, but it is recognized. The main thing that this scene tells me is that Valant and Bulk either have even more eyes than we expected them to around the city, kind of able to pick up on what Glockta is doing, like watching him very closely, but it has to be very closely. Or Severard is not quite as sneaky as we thought he could be. It's one of the two. I'm pretty convinced that Valant and Bulk have a wide-reaching network of lookouts. But
okay. Did you have any other notes that you're thinking of on Glockta's story or anything like that? Any kind of concluding thoughts?
This is the end. This is where Glockta's story finally ends. Just
this is where he dies. Yep.
This, I mean, we'll never go back to his perspective. Never see him again. I think, for the most part, Glockta's evolution as a character was pretty slow, but definitely tangible. Like he has become a much more likable and much more or much less two-dimensional character, I think, now compared to the beginning of the first book. But
sure. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think also the sort of command with which he grabs the story and kind of takes it by the reins when he gets to Dagoska is something that, like, I cite as a highlight in, especially in these first two books, just from a character perspective. Like, he is able to actually move and change and shake in ways that, you know, proves that he's competent at those kind of things, but then also gives him a lot more agency over the immediacy of the story.
I agree.
Cool. All right. So with that, we move into our next chapter, The Abode of Stones. We turn now to our adventurers on the shores of Shibulian after their long adventure west. In what feels like almost a nod to Jurassic Park Lost World, the boatmen refuse Baez's offer to come ashore with them. It's just a small thing, but I kind of appreciated it. But climbing the hill, they find this whole place to be absolutely desolate, covered in rocks with plants that look as though they want to jump off of it as well. This is not a place well-lived or trodden upon. It seems to be a sort of blasted or forgotten place on the edge of the world here. Logan says that they need to get out of the wind to build a fire to contact the spirits. There are also some remarks about Firo being, you know, a bit of a riddle to him at this point as well.
Mm-hmm. My first time reading through this, the beginning of this chapter, the descriptions of the rocks and foliage and the wind and everything make this place seem ominous and mysterious. But later read-throughs, it just feels desolate and a little bit like humorous to experience the foreshadowing a little bit, especially with the thousands and millions of rocks kind of comment getting repeated at the end. But yeah, I definitely remember feeling like, ooh, what's this like mysterious mountaintop or mountain island that we're... Plus Shibulian is such a good name. I don't know. But I liked having both Logan and Pharaoh's perspectives in this story, not necessarily in this section, but in this story, talking about the relationship and how it's evolved leading to this point. And I can understand Pharaoh's trepidation and sort of unwillingness to be vulnerable. But at the same time, I can totally get how Logan is confounded by that and calls her a riddle. So very well crafted to have both of them be perspectives in this story.
Yeah, yeah. It gives you, I mean, two sides of the coin, right? Like understanding and getting sort of that semblance of understanding miscommunication, especially as it might apply as like a trope to this, and sort of like a lack of understanding and sort of some of those cultural differences, the differences of where they originate from in general, you know, and sort of the ways their lives have gone, being like this unsolvable riddle to Logan, I think is just it's a great note on top of everything else. As far as the description of the island goes, yeah, man, in rereads, this is like the most obvious metaphor for, no, this place doesn't fucking matter. We say you want a wild goose chase.
Yeah.
And like, even Baez kind of hints at that. He hints at it, you know, in an ironic way, you know, with like the, where's the best place to hide a stone among millions of stones, you know, mm-hmm. thousands, hundreds of stones. And it's just, he thinks the whole thing clever, but it implies the sort of larger implication that this thing wasn't meant to be found. there was no intent for anyone to find it at any point. Yeah. So that said, of course, getting a little bit ahead of myself here, they make their way into the cave, build a fire, and Logan offers alcohol to the spirits, which Baez had been keeping kind of secret, blowing it out over the fire, kind of to everyone's chagrin once again. Like, you're just keeping alcohol from us? And we meet the
I can understand that. It would have been
I totally get it. Yeah.
They need this.
I totally get it. Yeah, it's a necessary item for the ritual. But we meet the spirit of whom is very quickly ready and accessible to give the rock to Pharaoh, which is a big deal. We then cut from Logan's perspective of seeing this real, actual spirit for the first time since the first book. And then we cut to Jezahl, of whom basically sees a rock sort of appear and float in the middle of the air and then drop into her hand, which is, I'm not sure if Logan's perspective on her pulling it out of her spiritual chest and then doing that is more horrifying or terrifying than a rock seemingly appearing from nowhere and then being dropped. You know,
yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, given the understanding of like how dangerous a weapon and how dangerous an item this is, I think it'd be more terrifying to just see it appear and drop into Pharaoh's hands. But they all like recoil back from it. They all react very tangibly and violently from it.
Yeah, yeah, because this is the seed. This is the other side made flesh. This is the thing that we've been hearing so much about. We've drawn the comparison to the ring. You've pointed out that it seems, especially in description, similar to a weapon of mass destruction in some ways. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily like an atomic bomb, but as though it provides a force in some ways reminiscent of something like that. And it is nothing more than a stone.
Just a normal fucking rock.
Just a rock.
It's funny. I think it's funny. It sucks given the, like, how much everybody has sacrificed to get here. The anger is justified and deserved. But it's kind of delicious. It's really kind of fun to relish in their misfortune a little bit.
Is it really just kind of delicious, or is it like ridiculously delicious?
It's delicious from bias, I think, more than anything. It's the rest of them are unfortunate casualties of this anticlimax.
Yeah, sure.
But bias is anger Jezahl. Is really delicious.
We'll get into this in a moment here, but I don't know if I think Jezahl is a victim in the same way, because Jezahl benefited a lot from this trip.
No, I totally. I mean, in this moment, how they feel, like their anger here.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Baez is the one that I'm like
you relish in,
relishing in. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That makes sense. I love the. There are all kinds of lovely quotes, of course, that come out of this. Of sort of Baez, you know, begins his sort of shaking rant and rambling of the ancient sage wizard that he is, and he says, Canadius has his hand in this. He found some way to trick his brothers and switch the lump of nothing for the seed and keep it for himself. Even in death, the master maker defies me. And just that level of frustration again, you know, is so much. But that, like, again, Baez's reveal of the duplicity of this whole thing just makes it all that much more, like you said, delicious. But on top of that, like, he has had a part to play in so much of Baez and Juven's, and less so Badesh's, but of this sort of like larger history and tapestry, and to also be kind of dissuaded by a number of the other wizards also along the way for different reasons of its destructive power and all of these other things, and continuing to pursue it, you know, to then be left high and dry because no one should have this kind of thing. I don't know. What were your thoughts? Your thoughts there?
My thoughts have been all over the place with this. One thought in my mind is, was there ever a seed? If so, much like Kwai asks, where did it go? Where is it actually? If not, like maybe the idea of the seed was entirely fabricated. But if that's the case, what caused all the destruction that we've witnessed? If this was an intentional fake out, like what does that mean? Maybe. If it was an intentional fake out, then the seed is somewhere else, as Baez is alluding to. But it's also possible, I think, that the seed has lost power or reverted into an inert rock over time. Is Canadius the actual, like, proper target of Baez's ire? Has something else happened? Like, we're going on a lot of speculation here. And I'm curious where it's all going to shake out.
Yeah, there is a lot of speculation on which direction this goes. So, yeah, which way was it really? And we're left to question that at the end because there are no answers sort of immediately on anything there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about something that it kind of goes down as a quote between Longfoot and Baez as he begins to mutter something about, well, it was really the journey. It's really about the journey, not about the destination, and is quickly cut off and shut up by Baez, of whom threatens to turn him into a pile of ash if he repeats one such flat nonsense ever again, in a lot of other insulting language towards Longfoot. But I'm curious about your thoughts about like Joe's commentary around sort of journey and destination as a theme with which we kind of judge characters versus how the characters actually feel, right? Like you and I have seen the changes in these characters, but the way that they feel is entirely different, of course, than the way that they've, you know, than the way that anyone perceives change in action and, you know, the way that they spend their time and lives.
Yeah, I mean, you can appreciate the idea that it's the journey over the destination. But I think Brother Longfoot is alone, probably, in having any experience with having a journey without a destination in mind. Like he's probably the single person that I could think of on this on the squad that has the luxury to have that experience. Like there aren't very many journeys that people go on. Like they wouldn't go on them without having the destination to begin with. So from a character's perspective, like of course it's incredibly frustrating to come to the end of this journey and have it all be for naught. And they also probably don't recognize the changes in themselves in the same way that we see the changes in them. Maybe a little bit they'll recognize it, but they don't see the large beats like we do. They see the monotony of the day-to-day and the little tiny incremental changes over time that don't amount to much step by step. So I don't know, man. I love this as a theme. I think Jizal, like we've been talking about for the last several weeks, is like the embodiment of that journey over destination, sort of what good comes out of that. And I can totally still understand his being upset with having lost all of these opportunities and like wasted a lot of time and time with Artie that he wouldn't have even realized that he wanted it without this journey. There's a lot of irony to it, but I can totally get the frustration. But that said, to refrain what we've been saying for a very long time and to solidify it in our final chapter coverage, he is a much better person now compared to what he was when he left or what he was when we met him at the beginning of the previous book.
Yeah, yeah. Our little Nepo bigot is a much more reasonable person.
Right. Maybe not in this moment, but in general.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe not immediately right now when he's mad and frustrated at everything. But yeah, yeah, man. I'm curious on the whole, outside of sort of the immediate sort of textual read that you're giving, how do you feel about this ending, you know, on for this journey in particular?
I think my answer will dramatically change based on how they actually break apart and how they actually like move forward in each of their respective stories. If they do break up like they're claiming to, or like they're planning to, I'm already wanting to see the band get back together, you know? But overall, I like this anti-climax, I think, as the end of this story for this group. I think it's humbling. I think it cuts down Baez's high and mighty vision of himself as the savior of the world, and keeps the brothers elevated above the Magi in a way. Man, I, what if this was the seed? What if this like was full power, the seed, and it just needed to like get wet or something? And yeah. They leave and then realize that, and then they have to like do it all again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just, yeah. I don't know. Overall, if it is at face value what it is, I think I'm pretty happy with it because of the way that it knocks Baez down a peg a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely knocks him down a peg. I love what you said about it also kind of preserves the brothers in a way and sort of their step above the Magi. Because I think that that's actually a great read that I hadn't considered, as it does kind of, in a way, again, my brain is only drawing comparisons to the Lord of the Rings, but you've got kind of the two godly classes of like the Maiar and the Valar, right? In the Lord of the Rings. And as those are separated, so goes the world. And this kind of leaves the Magi, of whom are all Valar? They're the lower class. All of the Magi are.
I think Maiar.
Maiar? Okay. I believe you. One or the other. Regardless, they are the lower class of sort of God. This similarly prevents, or at the very least shows, like that the old God still had a couple of tricks up their sleeves in some ways. Shapes and forms are still superior in whatever realm. But yeah. Yeah. To round out kind of the chapter on the whole, we get kind of the conclusion of where everyone is going to go with the party dividing itself. Pharaoh is desiring revenge upon the Gurkish almost immediately and wants to head back and kill them now that she's gone through this long quest and her debt in many ways is paid. Logan wants to head back to the north because he has debts that also need paying, and he really should have left in the first place. Yeah, scores to settle.
Throws Pharaoh off quite a bit.
Yeah.
Pharaoh mentions a name that I feel like we haven't mentioned, or if we have, it's been a long time and I don't recall. This is the thing that is to turn blank to ash. And it's not Gurkle.
Shaffa. Shaffa to dust. Shaffa is the name of the capital.
Okay, gotcha.
Of Gurkle.
Never mind. I didn't know if it was a person.
No, it's a town, but it will turn Shaffa to dust. Uthman al-Dosht, of course, is the person whom she wants to kill.
I knew that.
You know,
that, which yeah. is why I was confused about that. Have we yes. learned? Have they mentioned that name before?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. For sure.
I'm just a forgetful idiot.
It has happened 6 times in this book alone.
I shouldn't be such a forgetful idiot.
Well, I'm not saying you are. I never said that. I was just saying.
No, I said that.
It's a, well. I'm not trying to reiterate that upon you or put that evil on you. So, but yeah, so she's headed, of course, she can't turn Shaffa to dust, but she's going to go kill as many Gurkish as possible. Logan's going back up north to pay his debts, while Jizal, Quai, Baez, and presumably Longfoot head back to the Union to part ways there, likely before Quai and Baez go off and do whatever they're going to do.
So this is the contract. Thinking about Longfoot, this was the contract that Baez paid Longfoot for. Is Baez obligated to keep Brother Longfoot in his company?
I don't know, but I don't think he'd want to get rid of him, right? Like, he was a useful navigator, by and large.
Was he, though? Yeah, he was. But Baez liked to complain about how useless he was.
Yeah, because other than navigation, he is effectively useless. And even then, is he really? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's mutual benefit to be in a group and return back to the Union. But it would be kind of funny for Baez to be like, nope, fuck off. You can find your own way home.
Yeah, these guys will take you around the circle of the world and, you know, we'll see if you make it back.
There's probably a return trip clause in the Guild of the Navigators standard contract, right?
Probably something like that. One would assume. Yeah. Any notes on their like decisions and where they split? Outside of course, I mean, maybe the final thing to mention and bring up here too is the sort of nature in which Pharaoh and Logan split.
Yeah,
and sort of the pain that she feels in that moment as she wishes that she could have done something different, but like doesn't.
It just feels so bad. Like, if this is truly the end, it's a very unsatisfying end to their relationship and their camaraderie and their budding romance, if you want to call it that. But whatever they have, it sucks if this is the end of that. But it is kind of par for the course based on how they have always communicated.
Yeah. They kind of didn't have a great way of communicating and working their way through a lot of problems. So, you know, it's great in that way.
I would argue it's worse than not having a great way and actively having bad ways of dealing with it.
You know, okay, all right, fair point, BJ. I'm not, I'm definitely not trying to push back on that stretch of things. Like, you know, it's, yeah, fair enough. All right. Any notes to end our characters, most of our characters' journeys with?
Be gone, you lot. I don't know.
Be gone, lot. Yeah, the painful thing to me that I kind of want to end on with them at the very least before go to back to the mud is sort of that brutal part of Pharaoh, but specifically the last line. So just to repeat here, except that Pharaoh didn't have it in her and she knew she never would have. The Gurkish had killed that part of her far away and long ago and left her dead inside. She had been a fool to hope, and in her bones, she had known it all along. Hope is for the weak.
That's two very different philosophies that have both kept, like, between her and Logan. And Logan is a very hopeful person.
Hope is all he has.
By and large. Yeah. Exactly. And, her lack of it is just as strong as his faith in it, in keeping them breathing another day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. But I think they both share, what they do share is conviction in their belief or disbelief in hope.
Yeah. We'll see how exactly that levels out, of course. All right. So, our final chapter here of the book is Back to the Mud. So now I said that with so much bravado, but now I have to like take it down a notch because, you know, like this is not a happy chapter.
Let's go.
Sadly. but now we come to our burial in the post of our righteous combat with which we began this episode. As Dogman says in his head, it was a bad day for men all in all and a good one for the ground. Always the way after a battle. Only the ground wins.
Is this the same quote that Dogman had in his head when Forley was put in the ground?
I don't know. I don't think so.
No? For some reason, I remember that quote, only the ground wins.
It seems to be more similar to me in my head as to Pharaoh. It's sort of her different notes.
Right. Yeah.
That's kind of my thought.
I'm kind of taking this in the direction of like, we had the repeated questions chapter title over and over again. And this is now another repeated chapter title of Back to the Mud, with the last one being Forley's funeral. And I remember, like, I know, I think it was last week, like, I came to the conclusion that I kind of like the repeated chapter titles now. I'm kind of into it, with it being used sparingly and for questions alone in that sense, but fittingly having it here too as a repeated one, as a refrain. I think it works well. I liked it.
Yeah, I genuinely, I don't recall. I'm trying to search through it right now just to see, for some reason, my silly thing searched back through the other chapter. Hang on. No, it's close. I'll say that much. Three Trees has a quote that's pretty close. He says, that's all I've got to say. Back to the mud with you, Forley. We're the poorer and the ground's the richer for it.
That's the one. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Which feels similar. Like, that's pretty similar.
I mean, it's definitely thematically similar. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the end-all be-all of all of these things, right, in a lot of different ways, is as they deal with and rationalize the relationship with death and with the ground being where they go. Northmen seem to be the most realistic, but at the same time, Pharaoh's pretty realistic about it, too. To that point, I really appreciate each of the Northmen's reflection once again on death and its nature, but I found myself struck in this reread by how somber Black Dow was throughout this whole thing, this whole sort of section and moment with Three Trees and Cathel. It's such a great beat from the character that I personally greatly appreciate.
Yeah. Sorry to keep bringing up Forley's funeral, but we caught a glimpse of this side of Dow then. And this is a much clearer view of this side of him. Understandably, like, this was not just a compatriot, but a leader and a friend. And I mean, they had been, I don't know who he spent more time with, Forley or Three Trees, but Three Trees definitely left a big impression on everybody.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's very clear in the way that everyone reacts to this death, even compared to Forley's death, of course, is that this was an important named man. And I think after everyone kind of declines to speak up in regards to the death itself, I personally appreciate that all of our talkative Northmen shirk away, except for Grimm. Grimm goes on and gives a lovely speech that, what's his name? Stephen Pacey absolutely just kills and makes deep with so much emotion, even though it's effectively just a paragraph. So that quote here, of course, from Grimm, because all Grimm quotes are worth reading. Rud Three Trees, Rock of Uthrith, they called him. No bigger name in all the North. Great fighter. Great leader. Great friend. Lifetime of battles. Stood face to face with the Bloody Nine, then shoulder to shoulder with him. Never took an easy path if he thought it was the wrong one. Never stepped back from a fight if he thought it had to be done. I stood with him, walked with him, fought with him. 10 years all over the North. I have no complaints.
This is such a touching eulogy from a man who, I think this is the most words that we've gotten from him from all the rest of the two books combined.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got to be close. You know, I mean, someone might be able to go back and cut him through because he does mostly grunts. Every once in a while he says shit. He'll swear every once in a while. He had a sentence once. But yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. Especially as other Northmen are counting their dead and like Shivers is around the corner dealing with, you know, kind of his own men, including Dogman's sort of reflection on the nature of the dying being like just basically waiting for their turn to decide whether or not they're going to be interred. Like, that's also tragic. The man who has his hand cut off, you know, maybe he'll live, maybe he'll be in the ground with his friends. Kind of a deep tragedy as well on the battlefield here for them. Yeah.
Oh.
So the Union men are of whom are here to witness this burial, of course, walk away after the speech, of which another speech is also given for Cathel, although very brief. In consideration and in approach. Shivers approaches the group of them just unbearing his own men. He says that they need a chief and need to settle on it soon, but the conversation has already been had actually between our trio of Northmen that make up the remainder of this small group. Neither of them can accept the other, meaning Tol and Dow, as the leader, so it's up for Dogman to be it. Dogman is reluctant, thinking that his name doesn't mean much, but according to them and in recognition of everyone else, his name is actually the biggest left standing of them all, perhaps the biggest in the North, receiving a coterie of compliments from his crew of Northmen.
Oh, Dogman. Leader of the pack. I like this place for Dogman. I truly do think he'll thrive here. For all of the points that they laid out, him being the best scout that there is and kind of a unifying presence amongst the rest of them. Everybody else is so abrasive in their own special ways that it'd be hard for all of them to rally behind them. But Dogman makes sense. I do wonder why there was zero consideration for Grimm, though. Like, I don't think he'd be the right call either way. maybe I missed a line where like he was one off, like offhandedly disqualified from being leader, but I don't believe he was even mentioned in any of this conversation.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, Dogman brings him up as like a name among the trio of them, you know, and Dogman thinks about their names. So on the whole, you know, it doesn't seem to be any additional consideration on that side. But likely it seems like Grim maybe made himself heard previously. And that's why he basically, again, is just back to grunting at this point, acknowledging mm-hmm. what they're saying. By going, you know. Yeah. And it's so funny, of course, that Shivers takes it very seriously, says it's a good choice, and Dogman's our chief. Dogman's our boy.
Dogman's the man. He's waiting for, like, jeers and, you believed us kind of, like, jokes, but, yeah. Have some more self-respect for yourself, Dogman. Have some more confidence. You're a good leader. You got this.
Yeah. You're a great leader. You know when to jump. Sometimes you forget your mark and you forget which number you go on, but you know when to go.
Sometimes you forget if it's your right or their right. But it's okay.
To me, I think the thing that I appreciate about this too, especially since we just talked about our like ragtag band breaking up, is that this band is staying together. The band that by pretty much all accounts we think should have dissolved. You thought should have dissolved.
I didn't think should have dissolved. I
you thought would dissolve, I should say.
Yeah, I didn't quite have the understanding of why they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. But just kind of qualifying that still, you know, as like a thing. This was the one that seemed to be the group that was most likely to dissolve and leave.
Right.
Especially with the death of Three Trees, we would have assumed.
But so they've final experienced line the death of a leader before. They'll experience mm-hmm. another one. Or they yeah. believe they've experienced the death of a leader.
And they've added more men. You know, this crew is a lot bigger with Shivers and his men following along too.
Yeah.
Even after losing, you know, half a dozen.
Yeah, they're down to 29, but down to 29, up from six before.
Yeah, exactly.
So, or no, they buried like a dozen.
Plus Shivers. Yeah. Oh, did they bury a dozen? They're like 20 people. It's not that many. The core point remains.
Yeah.
That said, final line here that I really appreciate, of course, after he, you know, says his sort of different notes to both Cathill and Three Trees on their graves, he stands up and he did, quote, and he stood up and wiped his hands on his shirt and walked away back to the living and left the two of them behind him in the earth. And then, you know, the chains are rattling menacingly the whole time, especially if you listen to the audiobook and you hear the of the the audio transition.
So we've mentioned it a few times, but I really love the Northmen's customs and sensibilities around death. At face value, like at the surface, it feels callous and cold and maybe emotionless. But that's not the truth of it at all. Like it's practical, and there's meaning there, and there is a baggage carried for all their dead that's been imprinted on them. But it's not weighing them down to a certain degree. Like you think about Logan and his pot at the beginning of the story. It's practical to leave it behind, so he has to, but it's still like he still thinks about it. He's like, that was the last thing that I had on me that like all of us sat around and all of my dead friends, as far as he understood, shared with me. And like, he's still sentimental about it, even though he's not, like, it doesn't weigh him down in that respect. And I think that's the same thing here. It's a practicality. They have to move on. They have to move forward, and the dead aren't going anywhere. But yeah, I don't know. I like I like the way that the Northmen treat death. Is the crux of my point in a roundabout meandering way.
Yeah, it is. I appreciated your note on sort of the realism, the practicality, the, you know, core emotion being there. I think that there is something unique to just this being the way that the world is, right? Like, we have to deal with the sort of brutal reality of an old man of whom wanted nothing more than to retire and wish that he could have and should have had a dozen sons by now, as he talked about over the course of this book. And, you know, a woman of whom was just kind of approaching her prime in a lot of ways, being struck down really kind of really tragically and completely unfairly. And one of the things that strikes me in just sort of a really kind of like tragically ironic note too, is on some level, I don't want to say that any of this is strictly West's fault by sending them up into the woods, right? To like have that happen. I would never pin that on him. It was supposed to be a safe place. However, I do in my head, one of the what ifs that I like interrogate often is, you know, how different would it have been if Cathal would have gone with West and been with West instead of Dogman, and sort of the brutality of that choice and like doing the right thing she felt emotionally versus like the safety in her own to some degree. Her own culture, I should say, not like her own, but there's just something interesting there to interrogate as well of like, you know, the doing the right thing by yourself sometimes also yields just disproportionately inappropriate consequences.
Right. Yeah. It all ripples. It all. Who knows what Pike will say to all of this? And I don't know if he'll.
Well, Pike was there at the funeral, but he didn't, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't say anything.
Yeah, he was.
So was West.
Yeah.
But we didn't get their perspectives.
So. Yeah, we didn't get anything from either of them. And we didn't really see their reactions to much of anything. I don't know. I have a feeling that, man, it's a complicated stack of characters and interconnected feelings and emotions and things. And it'll be fun to get that untangled a little bit. Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot more on offer, PJ. Those chains rattle menacingly, beckoning us, calling us away and beckoning us forward to the next. So I am very excited. One of the things that I have to do this week in general is I have to finish my chapter breakdown so that I can get it updated on the website. But before we talk about that, we do have one more episode coming out between then and now, of course, when we start the final book in the trilogy before The Last Argument of Kings. We next week are going to be joined by the excellent Leanne from Leanne's Library, a YouTuber of whom is absolutely excellent, and I'm really excited to kind of chat with her. This is her favorite series, by and large, and she was one of the first to reply and got kind of the pick of the litter.
Nice.
A group of people that we'd talked to and was like, this one. And I was like, okay. And she's like, maybe this one too. And I was like, okay, probably that one too. You're right. So, you know, I'm very excited to get into this one with her.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very fun. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Should be a great time. So looking forward to that wrap up. With that, thank you so much to Tim and Andrew for all that you do for the show, for Atomic Pylon Media, of course, keeping all the shows lights on. Make sure you check out all of the other shows on the network, including Catacomb Party and Books and Baddies and Howler Pod as well, to just give them all a listen if this is your sort of thing. If you like more sort of nerdy everything, you know, is sort of the way that we approach this and tackle it. So
that's how we approach life in general.
True, true, true.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, please do so by searching Words Whiskey Pod on pretty much anything. You can also leave us a voicemail at 910-408-2534. If you do that, maybe we'll play it on the show. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. We probably will. We almost most definitely will. First person who does it.
Yeah.
Gets a cookie.
The fact that there hasn't been one played on the show means we haven't gotten a call yet.
kinda shocking, actually, considering we did get a number of calls in for the wrap up episode, but
that's true.
Then again, as it goes. beyond that, make sure PJ mentioned our social medias. You can also support us at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. We've simplified it all down to pretty much just one tier. And at that tier, you get access to our wonderful Discord community and our Devil's Cuts. And this, the rest of this month, for at least the next 2 weeks, I should say, we're releasing two episodes a week covering right now Dark Matter through its very end, and then the House of the Dragon as well. So we basically have turned that into like a little catch-up show in general, in which we normally generally catch up, but then in addition, doing a little bit of an experiment with some seasonal TV coverage, and people are enjoying it. So there we go. Yeah.
I think we'll keep that up. I have a feeling. Yeah. And it's it keeps me on track with like keeping up with shows that I want to watch. So I very easily fall off of that. And then like suddenly it's been 6 months and I still haven't watched whatever show. So
yeah, and they're like 20 to 30 minute bite-sized episodes too. It's not like the sort of some of the breakdowns that we've done on like episodic TV and stuff like that. This is a little different. So
yeah,
beyond that, make sure you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you don't leave us a review, we're gonna have to disembowel you in front of a square where everyone watches. So
and you're gonna enjoy it because it makes you remember how much it's good to have life. Yeah. No, wait, no, you're not. Everyone else, all your friends are going to like it, I guess.
All your friends are going to like it. I'm so glad that all these threats are out there. All right, perfect. Well, with that, we will talk to you next week.
See you then.